Hello, and welcome to A Good Science Read, where we discuss science books written for the general public. I'm Professor Francis Ashcroft, and my guest today is the hand surgeon Peter Birch. Peter is an honorary consultant at Oxford University Hospitals, a departmental lecturer in orthopaedic surgery at the University of Oxford, and a past president of the British Society for Surgery of the Hand. The book he has chosen is Dust, The Modern World in a Trillion Particles by Jay Owens. Dust is all around us and we breathe it in with every breath we take, but it's not something most of us think much about. Yet, as this book shows, it's incredibly important and impacts all our lives in multiple ways, causing environmental disasters and damaging our health. Jay Owens combines history, politics, travel writing, and science to tell the story of dust, from particulates that cause air pollution to toxic dust from dried-up seas, radioactive nuclear fallout, and the role of dust in shaping the climate. Peter, what did you think of the book?
I enjoyed the book a lot. It's an interesting mix. The notes on the cover sheet refer to Jay Owens' graduate thesis in geography, which was on dust. And the book does have something of an academic feel in parts. It has hundreds of references, but it's fleshed out with stories of the people, indigenous people and settlers who were involved, and with the accounts of her own travels to the California desert, the dust bowls of the Great Plains and the dried remains of the Aral Sea in Uzbekistan.
You know, I found it rather a slow start, especially those chapters on the dust bowls, because there was quite a lot of travel writing and not so much science. But I changed my mind as soon as I read the later chapters where there was lots of science and it was actually incredibly fascinating. Which was your favourite chapter?
Oh, I think I enjoyed most material that's covered in the second chapter and also towards the end, about the abstraction of water from the Owens Valley to provide water for the San Fernando Valley and the people of the expanding city of Los Angeles.
Oh, yes, and that was quite extraordinary too, wasn't it? Because the aqueduct, which took the water from the valley to Los Angeles, eventually the people in the valley got so fed up with the water being taken that they bombed it. And the water all came out.
Yes, yes. And in fact, very little of it actually reached Los Angeles. Most of it was used for irrigating crops in the San Fernando Valley. And as she says several times in the book, to a considerable extent, the story of dust is the story of absence of water.
One of the things about that chapter too is that what happens when the lake dust when the lake dries out is that the dust is then blown away, and it's laced with not just salts but also things like arsenic and cadmium. I was quite surprised.
Yes, yes. I'd forgotten that some lakes in the world have no natural outflow to the sea, so the lake in the Owens Valley receives the meltwater from the eastern side of the Sierra Mountains. It's all, it runs over the rocks, the sediments, the salts, the heavy metals are leached out over thousands of years, and they all stay where the water has carried them, down to the sediment of the lake, and they would have stayed there forever, she says, until the men from Los Angeles decided they wanted the water from the Owens Valley.
But there's a similar story, isn't there, about the Aral Sea that comes in a later chapter, which I found quite extraordinary, because when I was a kid, the Aral Sea was a great blue blob on the map.
Yes.
And it's completely vanished. It's, what did she say, one of the greatest environmental disasters.
Yes.
And we don't really know that much about it. And as far as I recall it, it sort of started in the 1960s when they diverted water for irrigation of cotton crops.
Cotton is one of the crops that really uses water.
Mm.
Of course, Uzbekistan was then under control from Moscow, and every region had its targets for production, which, of course, went that the targets were missed every year, but next year's target was greater.
Yes.
There was the political pressure, this is under Brezhnev and Khrushchev, I think, the targets weren't met. Huge areas of cotton were planted. It was a monoculture, so it required herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers in increasing quantities. And where did these go? They all went again into the Aral Sea, which had no natural outflow. Uzbekistan, of course, being one of the two countries in the world, says Owens, that is itself surrounded by only by landlocked countries.
Yes. And then, of course, when the sea dried out, all those toxic chemicals and fertilizers and things were carried in the dust.
Yes.
And affected the health of the people downwind of it. She has a marvellous phrase, I think, the dry tears of the Aral.
Mm.
And the thing that I also found fascinating was that the dust is actually not just confined to the immediate region, but gets blown around the world and ends up in places like Norway and Greenland. But Owen's Valley has a rather nicer ending than the Aral Sea story, because in a much later chapter, she comes back and explains how remediation plans are now really making a difference. The water was brought back into the region, and the plants and the, incredibly, all these birds came back.
It was certainly a more optimistic story than the Aral Sea. She says it was the largest dust mitigation effort in the world. And of course, the Americans considered, as they should, all of the possible solutions. But only in America could you consider tarmacking the whole Dust Bowl.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I think there were areas where they put down gravel, but
yes.
But that's probably not been as successful as getting the plants to knit the ground together.
No, it was really dividing the area into smaller pieces of shallow water with salt grass and gravel. She says by 2019, it had cost $2.1 billion, which is $50,000 for each inhabitant of the Owens Valley. And as you say, the result was unexpected, a real profusion of life, especially migratory shorebirds. And of course, the original lake was 110 square miles, but most of that was open water. And by creating the smaller ponds, there was much more shoreline. And hence,
and much more life, which is actually rather a wonderful end to the story. So then she goes on to talk about the Dust Bowl in the great US plains, doesn't she? And how 3 million people were starved out, the biggest migration in US history. And what's interesting, I think, is that she is quite political and discusses all the ethical arguments, because the lands which were taken either for for water, or in this case, for crop cultivation, were all taken from the Native American people, who, of course, had no say in the matter and actually had taken care of the land for so many years. And now this wasn't happening.
There are fascinating extracts from the oral histories of the settlers and some from the indigenous people, which gave me an insight that I'd lacked before. I was aware that millions of people had migrated, and in my misunderstanding, I thought it was really because they'd damaged the plains, which had become infertile. I hadn't appreciated the quantities of dust. There were days when it would darken the sky right across to the East Coast. They turned on the streetlights in New York City in the afternoons, and dust was removed with snowplows in Indiana.
It's incredible.
An amazing quantity of dust. And some of the oral histories describe how it crept in through every crack and crevice in the hand-built wooden houses. If you were cooking stew, the dust would settle on the surface. And when you went to bed at night, you turned the pillow over because the surface was covered in dust.
Extraordinary. And one man said, to watch 5 inches of soil blow away from your farm is to watch thousands of years of geological labour disappear.
Yes.
And of course, the dust wasn't good for people, so many of them got very ill and died as a consequence.
Interestingly, the the drought that plagued the 1930s ended with the arrival of rain in 1939, and then the great industrial effort in World War II stimulated new technology for water pumps, and that transformed the plains in the 1940s, but only at the cost of depleting the vast aquifer, which for millennia had received less than an inch of rain per year, but they're taking out feet per year. So, as she says, for 70 years, agribusinesses have borrowed from the deep past, and eventually the bill will come in.
And then she moves on to talk about going from dust on your pillow to talking about how we clean houses. And I found this the least satisfactory chapter for me, because I think I know too much about housework and I prefer to leave the dust to accumulate. But what was fascinating was about how many particles there are in a cubic meter of air. What was it, 35 million or something? And when you have to have a clean room in order to build computer chips and things, it has to be very, very much less than that, just 10 particles, less than 0.1 of a micron per air. So that's quite a cleaning operation.
Yes, she really traces the history of dirt and cleanliness, dirt, of course, all the way through the 19th century, and then the clean household, much more of a concept in the 20th century. But I love the line that she attributes to the anthropologist Mary Douglas, quote, "Dirt is matter out of place." Reminds me of weeds in the garden. But she goes further back to coal. I didn't know that the Romans mined coal extensively in Britain by the end of the second century. In the 11th century, she says, smoky coal was shipped from Newcastle to London. In 1605, London was importing a ton of coal per person per year, and this is before the Industrial Revolution.
That's just for heating and cooking.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. And so, of course, London's architecture, actually like Oxford's, if you remember from the early 1970s, London's architecture turned black. So in 1954, she relates, during the restoration of Downing Street, they cleaned the walls and discovered they were faced with yellow brick, which was a big surprise. So they painted it black.
But of course, for me, that chapter is also about the subjugation of women in order to do, because yes, they were the ones who had to do all the cleaning and all the housework. And, yes, and what a terrible task to spend all your day cleaning and then have to do it all over again the next day. And especially for the poor people, because, of course, their job was to clean the households of the rich, and then they had to go back home and clean their own.
Yes, she says at the end of the 19th century, one in three young women aged 15 to 20 worked in domestic service. Mm-hmm. Astonishing. There's remarkably little about the vacuum cleaner, actually. You think in a book on dust, it might have a larger profile.
But then we come to the stories that I really, really loved. I found the chapter on ice, the melting of the glaciers and the ice cores, extremely interesting. Because you might not think that the Greenland ice sheets are full of dust, but it turns out that actually they are. And some of it's cosmic dust that comes from meteorites or asteroids that are burned up in the atmosphere. And some of it comes from interstellar space, extraordinarily. Mm-hmm. And some of it's earth dust that's carried there by winds, which is sort of dust from volcanoes and radioactive particles and pollutants from the past.
Yes, the ice cores are a good record of what's happened in the past. Not easy to collect, you would think from the description in the book, but very informative and really worrying for the future of the climate.
Yes, she has a marvellous bit there about how lead is also detected in the ice cores, and it maps the economics of ancient Rome, because they used lead to smelt silver. So every time they needed more coinage to pay for something, there was more lead found in the ice cores. And of course, they're full of pollen grains that can tell you what was growing at the time, and soot from fires and glass from volcanoes and salt, which told you, can tell you how far you are away from the sea, or you were at that time. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I found particularly fascinating was I knew that from the particles of air that are trapped in the ice cores, you can determine how much carbon dioxide was in the air. But I never understood how they could determine the temperature. And it explains here that they measure the ratio between oxygen 16 and oxygen 18. Oxygen 18 is an isotope of oxygen that's heavier and it needs more energy to stay airborne, so there's less there when it's in the, you know, when the temperature is cold. Completely fascinating.
What did you think about the chapter on radioactive fallout? It didn't seem to me quite to fit with some of the other themes in the book, but it's a good description.
That chapter made me incredibly angry. I was incensed by the way people were treated by the authorities. Mm. I mean, I thought that was a very interesting chapter. I hadn't realised that the fallout from Hiroshima and Nagasaki was much less than that from nuclear testing. And actually, 2.4 million people are estimated to be going to die as a consequence of nuclear testing. In a sense, America bombed its own people by the nuclear tests. But we won't know, really, whether it's radioactivity because that's causing people's death because it's such a delayed killer. The half-life of the radioactive particles can be extremely long.
Yes, and there are so many deaths from cancer, for example, it's very hard to separate those that were due to the pollution. And in fact, the 1991 study that she cites, it just suggests that perhaps 2.4 million people, I think it's really difficult to give accurate numbers. Mm. And she, in fact, covers these difficulties in estimation of the long-term dangers quite well. And makes a parallel with the difficulties in assessing the impact of climate change on human health. Mm. Also very difficult.
Also very difficult.
I had not appreciated that since the bombs in Japan in 1945, the number of nuclear devices exploded in the world was 2,056, half of them in America. It's an extraordinary number.
There were a lot of people who were affected by those. They were thought to be done. It was said that they were done in uninhabited areas, but in fact, people were there. It's just they were indigenous people or small populations or uneducated who were considered to be expendable by the government. Mm. I think, for me, the amazing story, one of the amazing stories is that of the Bullock brothers who grazed their sheep 40 miles northeast of a test site in Nevada. And if you remember, one day an officer arrived and told them they were in a hell of a hot spot. And they had to get their sheep and themselves out of there extremely fast. And as they moved the flocks west, the sheep started to die, hundreds and hundreds of them. And when they put a Geiger counter on the sheep's carcass, the needle swung off scale. And the lawyer, when they tried to claim compensation, said to them, "We admit we killed your sheep. We admit it. But you're going to lose this case in court because every pregnant woman, every sick person will sue the government. And not only that, they'll stop these tests. And these tests have to go on." Mm. So basically, tough luck. And then there was another story, if you recall, I also found very upsetting, which was about the uranium mining on the Navajo land, which was initially welcomed as it brought employment. But the dust was radioactive and it destroyed people's health. And the mine companies knew all about the danger and they told their supervisors not to tell their workers. Mm. And when they tested it, dust in 85% of the Navajo homes contained radioactive uranium. It just made me angry about the thoughtless way that people had been treated.
Yes, there's a lot in the book about social justice. About water justice. Mm-hmm. In fact, there could have been perhaps more coverage about water justice, about the potential for water conflict in dry areas in the world. That's too big a subject for the book to extend to.
I'm afraid it's coming in the future, though.
Yeah,
we will not get away with that, and that will cause mass migration, and life will become much more difficult.
There wasn't much on smoke from wildfires, which are increasingly troublesome and, of course, related to climate change in some way. And that clearly that smoke produces a lot of dust.
She did describe how dust affects climate change, though. There was quite a considerable discussion about how the atmospheric winds carry dust all around the world. Mm. And so we sometimes get sand from the Sahara blowing over Europe. And of course, what we don't realise is that quite often that sand is contaminated because of the tests, nuclear tests, the French carried out in Algeria. And so it's coming back to haunt us.
But on the other hand, volcanic dust, which blows around the world, is quite fertile and has done quite a bit to improve fertility of soils in places where it lands.
That was also a fascinating thing to me. I hadn't appreciated that dust fertilises the Amazon basin. And nor did I know that, in fact, what did she say? 140 million tonnes of dust are blown up into the atmosphere and fall into the Atlantic Ocean, where they fertilise the sea and stimulate the growth of more algae and diatoms and things which are contained in the dust. Nor that they also can have a toxic effect because they carry Aspergillus spores, which poison the coral reefs in the Caribbean. It becomes incredibly difficult to work out whether dust is good or bad, I think, when you read this.
Yes, there was a lovely line in the section on cleanliness. She cites a satirist from the 1950s saying that when a dear and trusted friend calls on you, you never know when that friend will slide a white glove finger along the skirting board behind the couch.
It's the sort of thing which mother-in-laws are said to have done, isn't it?
Yes.
And of course, the dust can, if it's white dust, can reflect like back from the sun, whereas dark dust can absorb it. So again, and of course, dust has an effect on clouds and cloud formation. So it becomes very difficult for the climate change modellers to understand how to fit dust into the whole of the cycle of their models. I thought there were one or two things that she'd left out because it was a vast topic, so it's quite clear she couldn't cause everything. But there was no mention of the Chernobyl explosion in 1986. And I remember that very distinctly because a friend of mine called me up from Sweden and said, "Fran, listen to this." And what I heard was a cackle of a Geiger counter, which was in the puddle outside his window.
Gosh.
And, of course, it led to the banning of the consumption of Welsh sheep, if you remember, for 26 years because of the dust that fell in the Welsh mountains. But having said all of this, I think she did a wonderful job on dust and it made me think about things which I'd never thought about before. You're listening to A Good Science Read with me, Frances Ashcroft, and my guest, Peter Birch. My book choice for Peter is The Species That Changed Itself, or How Prosperity Reshaped Humanity by Edwin Gale. The book combines anthropology, biology, history, epidemiology and science with fascinating stories and literary references to tell the story of our phenotype. Our phenotype, that is the way we look and behave, things like height, weight, skin colour and so on, is determined by the interaction between our genes and our environment. But unlike all other species, we've created our own environment. And in doing so, Gale argues, we have reshaped ourselves, both our physical bodies and our behaviour. Today, we enjoy an existence our ancestors could only dream of. We live longer, healthier, and better nourished lives. We're also taller, fatter, and think and behave differently. We have changed ourselves. Did you enjoy the book, Peter?
Oh, very much. It's a really detailed account of human history. And as you say, how humans have shaped the world and how in that shaping they've changed themselves. And it ranges across biology, social anthropology, epidemiology, history, It's peppered with references to literature from the Trojan Wars to Lilliput. Its descriptions of deprivation and poverty are really striking. And as you say, the author shows how better human health, better nutrition, better housing have contributed to our increase in height, weight, and of course to our greater opportunities than were present before.
I think he has a very engaging manner and quite a dry wit, don't you think?
Yes.
And the science is rather cleverly interwoven with all the other things, so it doesn't actually feel much like a science book. It's just a good read. And there's a good reference section. I would say he sometimes gets diverted into asides, so you can lose the thread of his argument, but the asides are always entertaining. So I really enjoyed it.
So I struggled a bit with my imperfect knowledge of genetics. As you say, the phenotype is the expression of our genes. It reflects the interaction between our genes and the environment. And he's trying to show that the way we've changed the world has changed our phenotype. And that's certainly true, because better in any generation, better maternal health, better nutrition changes the phenotype to make us taller and so on. What wasn't clear from the book, I found, is how much those changes reflect changes in the genotype. And for example, we know that humans inherited resistance to infectious diseases has changed. It's an inherited resistance to infectious diseases is important in human health, and that's changed over time. The persistence of lactase to allow you to digest milk has been shaped by human agricultural practices.
I see what you're saying. It's absolutely clear that in the last 50 years, the increase in obesity is definitely not to a gene change, because they don't happen so quickly, usually. But if we're talking about 30,000 years, maybe some of it is eventually genotype rather than phenotype. But what I found fascinating is that 20 to 30 years ago, hunter-gatherers were as tall as we are, and they were leaner and much fitter. And then 10,000 years ago, we invented agriculture and settled in cities. And it's then that things started to change for the worse for us. Because, of course, we became a great deal shorter, and we lived much less longer. And he argues that our jaws got lighter, narrower and longer as we no longer used our incisors for tearing and cutting meat, and that Anglo-Saxon skulls have got ground down molars because they were crushing a lot of seeds on their back teeth.
Okay, so then those changes in the shape of the jaw are not phenotypic changes, they're genetic changes, aren't they?
Well, they have to be genetic changes, I think. Yes, but he would argue, I think, that we have still changed our phenotype, and that because we were living in an environment where we were eating, crops and so on, grains that required this sort of thing, those people who were better fitted to crush them had maybe lighter and different jaws.
Yes. So it's the natural selection acts on the phenotype.
Yes.
But the effects are on the
genotype. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the other things I thought was fascinating was that our intestines resemble those of carnivores. They're much shorter than those of other primates, which are vegetarian, which I didn't know. I knew that the chimpanzees and things, they eat a lot of vegetation and they can digest cellulose because they've got guts with lots of bacteria in. But apparently, really, the reason we can eat vegetables and things is basically because we learn to cook.
Yes.
So Prometheus and the discovery of fire was a major invention in the human story.
Yes, as he says, we are the only animals who arrive on the world naked and remain naked. And that was only possible because we had fire.
Yes. And of course, you were right that when we come together in cities, which of course is necessary for agriculture, because you, if you've got a crop, you've got to stay and look after it. Mm. You can't move around. Then, of course, we got crowded together and infectious diseases came and we stopped having parasites like tapeworms and so on, and have parasites which are basically infectious diseases like COVID.
Though I think the tapeworms were still present. Tapeworms, roundworms were still fairly prolific through the 19th and early 20th century, and are still, of course, a problem in many parts of the world.
Yes, and we haven't lost bed bugs either.
The chapter on the inventions that fed the world were interesting, and here there was some good history. Of course, I was aware that ability to fix nitrogen from atmospheric nitrogen by Haber and Bosch in Germany is the reason we can now feed the increasing population of the world. I hadn't realised that one of the drivers for it was the blockade of Germany in World War One, which cut off its supplies of nitrates from Chile. And nitrates, of course, are required for the manufacture of explosives. So,
yes,
as is very often in human history, it's the drivers of the military and war that lead to developments that benefit humans later on.
That's actually true about medicine as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Much of modern medicine is derived from what happened during war.
Yes, advances in surgery hundreds of years ago came from treating the injured on the battlefield.
He has some interesting arguments about obesity, I thought. He argues that obesity is not a disease, that it's a phenotype and an inevitable result of the way we live now. He says obesity hasn't caused life expectancy to drop, nor caused an epidemic of heart disease, so that while obesity is a dreadful affliction, it's counterproductive to call it a disease. Do you agree?
It's difficult to call it a disease, I think. It's a phenotype, it's a risk factor, though he has this interesting account of how, as obesity has increased, the prevalence of cardiovascular disease has decreased. Now, he doesn't say that there's any causal connection between those two, but they've happened at the same time. And undoubtedly, the reduction in arterial disease will be multifactorial. He cites one of our previous Regius professors of medicine, William Osler, who would treat middle-aged men with coronary artery disease by saying that they should slow down, work gently, be respectful of God, and avoid mining shares, which I thought was interesting.
Stress, yes.
Stress, possibly.
I thought it was also amusing he describes Lord Byron as the first celebrity dieter. I didn't know this, but he was 88 kilograms when he was an undergraduate at Cambridge, which is probably less than the average man weighs now. And that didn't suit the fashionable icon of the romantic poet. So he soaked his food in vinegar and reduced his weight to 57 kilograms within 5 years. That's quite a weight loss.
It is. Why did he just not stop eating it? But anyway.
He also discusses how maternal nutrition has a marked influence on her child's phenotype and future health, and how bigger mothers have bigger babies, better nourished mothers, I mean, have bigger babies, and the babies grow taller, and then they have children who are also taller, and that smaller babies have a greater risk of high blood pressure and heart disease. And there's a fascinating stories of how that came to be known, which involved looking at ancient records that one rather wonderful woman had collected many years ago.
There are striking figures about the about height. He records that in 1835, if you plot the height of Belgian boys as they grow older on a modern height chart, then the Belgian boys are on the third centile.
Yes. And he also has a very interesting comment about height in Korean people. So South Korean women are 20 centimetres, that's 8 inches taller than North Korean women, because they're better nourished.
But it's, they were prior to 1950. No, now. Indeed now, but prior to 1950, they were the same height.
Yes.
But then when the border was created after the Korean War, this huge discrepancy has occurred.
Which is definitely an indication of how we have changed ourselves by our environment.
Yes. But it is only a result of the food shortages in North Korea.
Yes.
If the food supply is increased, those people will also gain in height. Yeah.
I also thought it was fascinating that in 1900, 90% of the people of the men who volunteered to fight in the Boer War were in such poor physical condition that they were unfit for service.
The officers were much taller than the men.
Yes, and that is also appalling in a way, isn't it? It just shows you how poverty affects your health and your what's possible for you in the future. He also says aging is not a disease. Do you think that's right? A huge amount of current investigation is predicated on the idea that it is, and that we will be able to live more healthier lives for longer.
I don't think it's a disease.
I don't think it's a disease either. Mm. But I love his comment, successful aging is when the doctor doesn't know what to write on your death certificate.
There's a picture in the book of an art installation at the British Museum in the early 2000s. It's all the pills that an 80-year-old lady had consumed during her life. The average 80-year-old lady had consumed during her lifetime. It's 14,000 pills.
Yes, it's in the British Museum, isn't it? I've seen it. It's extraordinary. It's an incredibly long table.
Actually, when you think about it, 3 pills a day for a year is about 1,000 pills. And for 14 years, doesn't seem so much.
He does have an interesting way of looking at things. He says that we equate youth with health, and thus we think of the old as unhealthy. But because they're actually the ones who survive, maybe we should think of them as being healthy. But maybe we're not looking at it in the correct way, which I thought was fascinating. And he also discusses to what extent we might be considered a domesticated species. Because like domesticated animals, we're heavier, have lighter skeletons, smaller jaws, reach sexual maturity earlier, breed freely, tolerate crowding, and are less aggressive than our ancestors.
He relates the scientific work in Russia on the silver fox, if you recall, where they bred repeatedly, selecting those that were more docile or seemed more friendly. And the test was to insert a prudently gloved hand into the cage. And if it wasn't bitten, then they would breed from those foxes later. And in a short space of time, I mean, 50 or so generations, they produced much more docile animals that looked more like puppies than adults, that had floppy ears and shorter noses. And these were the sort of changes that one associates with the modern dog.
I think it's fascinating. Why should being domesticated mean you have floppy ears?
Yes.
I suppose they just look cute.
Yes, presumably it's linked to some of the other things that they're selecting for, but I don't know.
Anyway, that was a fascinating book.
Yeah.
And it's all we have time for today. My thanks to my guest, the hand surgeon, Peter Burge. The books we have been discussing are Dust, The Modern World in a Trillion Particles by Jay Owens, which was published by Hodder and Stoughton in 2023. And we also discussed The Species That Changed Itself, or How Prosperity Reshaped Humanity by Edwin Gale, published by Penguin in 2020. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.